Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
This is Radiolab, and our show today is about being witness to something.
It's actually not something you really choose to witness.
Yeah, you feel like, should I be seeing this? And we're going to start with a story from our friends over at Radiotopia, Nick Vanderkoek and Brendan Baker. This is a story that, for me, speaks to like what it's like to live in a city. When you look out the window, we're all so jammed together that suddenly you're seeing into the lives of somebody else through their window, and you just kind of fall into it without even wanting to.
In this particular tale, what is observed is so surprising and so for its tenderness and for its quiet love that it's a rare thing to see. So we wanted to send it your way.
So here we go. This is how their story begins.
So I'd been living in my apartment about 15 years. And one evening I walked in the living room, which has three bay windows which face the gardens in the back. And over half a block of gardens and across a small street, there was this bright window that I'd never noticed before. But it's at the exact eye level of my third floor apartment. And after a while, I realized that I'd never seen it because there had always been curtains. And so it was always, I think, dimly lit. The curtains were often closed. And all of a sudden, there's this bright light and no curtains. And it was like a movie screen. And that window has meant nothing. I haven't even noticed it. And now it's all I think about. There were new tenants, and it had always been a living room, and now it was suddenly a bedroom. And there were these two people in there, and they were naked. This young couple in their 20s. They were really lovey-dovey, and they were always naked.
That's Diane Weipert, who tells the story, and she told it to radio reporter Brianna Breen, who produced this piece with Nick and Brendan.
The thing is, they pushed their bed so that the head was up against the windows. So their heads, you could see both of their heads lying there. So you'd see things that you just, like, they were just shocking. I just had been there all of this time, and suddenly you could see people having sex really clearly, like amazingly clearly. I had no idea that you could see so well across such a distance. And it was really uncomfortable. My husband and I were still adjusting to parenthood, and it wasn't the most romantic time in our lives. And my son was probably 3, and when you're new parents to a toddler, especially because he sleeps in bed with us too, so he's like literally right between us, the last thing you need is a couple of hotties getting it on across the window, reminding your husband of everything he's not getting. So to have this really beautiful young woman that was really thin and naked all the time, really, you know, it was very frustrating. And you know, she had this beautiful, tall, lanky, well-built boyfriend. And so at first I just, because I felt like my husband was going to be staring at this naked woman all the time, I started closing the living room curtains, which is really kind of silly. And it made our room really dark, and we never closed those curtains. And so that didn't work. So I thought about like making a really big sign that said like, close your curtains or buy curtains. They didn't even have curtains. Buy curtains, we can see you. And I thought about going by their building. I had no idea what their unit was, and leaving a note. And then I started thinking that was really silly and prudish, and started realizing that they were just young and I had to just get over it and live with it and move on. And so that's what I did. We got really used to them, and they became sort of this symbol of what we used to be, you know, in our 20s. And they were living this really carefree time. And that's another thing that it was kind of hard not to sometimes, when you're in early parenthood, you get a little bitter, I think, about some of those freedoms. And we'd watch them sleeping till 11 while we'd been up since 5 with our toddler. And we saw them eating breakfast on the roof together. So we got used to it, and we would notice, like, oh, look, they got a new, you know, plant in there. And they became sort of part of our lives, you know, because they were just always there and never, ever bought curtains.
Do you think all the neighbors in your building and the surrounding buildings also saw this?
It's funny. I think that the way that we're positioned, because all of the buildings around us are different sizes, and our building is the tallest one on our block, but it's exactly at the right level to see their windows. I have a friend next door and then a friend across the way, and all of them have windows facing the gardens, but not all of them are blocked. And I look at the other windows of the buildings around us, and I don't think anyone has this perfect level view. The irony is that I'm such a private person. And I don't know, am I supposed to have maybe respected their privacy and just looked away? But it's impossible, because that's the way the chairs face. They face the window. I couldn't not see them if I wanted to. But I guess I could have not gotten the binoculars. So time went by. And this is maybe a year and a half later, 2 years later. And I remember seeing their room, and the light was on, but it was empty. And I thought that was strange, because it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and they never went anywhere early. And it was like that for like a whole week. It was just this empty room with the light on. And I thought that was strange. They didn't seem to be there as often, or maybe just she would be there and he was gone for long periods of time. And we just kind of forgot about them. You know, there wasn't as much action going on, and they weren't as present. And so we just kind of lived our lives and forgot about them for maybe 7 or 8 months. At the end of last year, in December, there was this night when my husband and I separately had both seen this woman naked sitting in the window, kind of chubby, slump-shouldered woman who was just looking down at the street. And we both thought it was so strange. Just couldn't figure out who she was and what she was doing and why she was naked. And a few nights later, there was this young man standing right at the window by the bed. And he was skeletal. He was so thin. And he was bald completely. And we realized it was the same couple. They had completely changed. He was sick. There was something serious wrong with him. After that, I just watched the window all the time. He would sit all day. He was there because I work from home. And I would see him all day in the bedroom, either lying down or sitting at the computer. And then after a couple of weeks, he was just lying down. And he was just there. And his bald head would be up against the pane of glass all the time. And she would be there. And she'd come in and she would bring him things. But mostly it was just him there by himself. And sometimes he would have like his knees bent, and you could just see how skeletal they were. They were just bones. And sometimes he'd kick off the blankets, and he was just lying there naked and emaciated. And then after a while, he was just always burrowed under the blankets. I found myself thinking, like, well, maybe he's been through chemo and he's recovering, and, you know, he's going through this this sick phase before he gets well, because he's so young. He's just such a young guy. And so we had to go to Colorado to see my family for Christmas. And I worried all the time I was there. I thought about them, and I worried that he wasn't going to be there when we got back. I worried all the time about it. When we got back, about 10 days later, he was still there. But his head looked so much smaller, and there were a lot of people there. And then I got out my binoculars. I got my birding binoculars. I'm not proud of it, but at that point, I felt so invested. It looked like people coming to say goodbye. And there was this sort of short, blonde Midwestern looking woman who I guessed was his mother. And then there was this young guy who just kept pacing the halls. You know, you could just see there were two doorways leading out of this room, and you could just see him go down one side and through the other and then back and forth and back and forth. And I figured he was the brother. And it looked like the girlfriend's sister was also there. It was just a guess. Looked like her. I remember there was just this little gathering going on in the living room right below. The neighbors were standing around and having drinks, and they had no idea at all what was going on right upstairs. I would watch people come and go. Then after a while, everyone left except for the girlfriend and the mother. And I spent all that evening like sitting vigil on the back of the couch and watching. And I remember the girlfriend lying beside him for a long time on her own, and she was just stroking his face so tenderly. It was so much affection that really transcends the kind of young love that you expect. All I could see was the top of his head all that time. And I remember later seeing her standing by the bed with the mother on the other side, and they were just all talking, and she put a hand on his forehead. She put the back of her hand on his forehead, and then she was wiping at her eyes. And you could tell that there was this sense that something, that it was getting closer. Then I could see this reckoning where she was wiping at her eyes and touching his forehead and wiping at her eyes. And there were candles lit, and this young woman was on one side and his mother was on the other side. And they just were lying there for a really long time, and they had their hands just resting on his chest. And so I watched it for a long time. The mother and the girlfriend were lying on either side of him, and you could tell this was the end. I thought, now all that's left is the girlfriend and the mother, and inexplicably, me. Me, like I am one of the three people at the deathbed. And they lay there for a long time. And then they just got up and they went into the other room. And I realized that must have been the moment. And all this time, you know, I always had this sense that, you know, they're going to break up. They're going to move out. Nobody that age stays together very long. And I had no idea. It was just like this beautiful love story. So the next day, I got up and I went to the window first thing. And they were folding up blankets and stacking them on the bed. And I figured that he had been taken away. And so I was in the kitchen and my husband called because he knew how obsessed I'd gotten with this situation. And he said, there's activity over there. And I came running and I got my binoculars and I looked. And and realized that he was still there. He was still in the bed. His body was still there. And it was the coroner. So the coroner and his assistant came, and they had these white plastic gloves on, and they pulled his body to the edge of the bed and onto this white sheet. And I just remember the lifelessness of it. It looked so shrunken. It almost looked like a shrunken rubber proxy of a body. So incredibly dead. They wrapped him in the sheet and they zipped him into a vinyl bag and they put him on this kind of gurney. They took the gurney out, and I just had this very strange impulse, and I ran and threw on my coat kind of over my pajamas and ran out to the street and ran to the corner. And I got there just as they were hauling him out. They were carrying him out, and the girlfriend was there. She was talking to one of them in the doorway, and they loaded him into this van. And I realized that they didn't know me at all. Like, I had, you know, I had no place to be there. And they looked at me. I remember the coroner's assistant looking at me like I was sort of like a rubbernecker in the street, you know, looking at this grisly scene. And I realized that's what I was. I had no place to be there. And suddenly it all felt so perverse. And so I went home and I felt very strange about the whole thing. And I tried to tell myself that, well, I never wanted to be part of their lives. I was the one that wanted them to put up curtains. I wanted them to shut the intimate stuff out. I was uncomfortable with it. I was the one that wanted out. And I started remembering all of a sudden when I moved to that apartment so many years ago, and I was in my mid-20s, that I had to share the apartment with a roommate because it was too expensive. And my bedroom was in the living room. And I remember how when I first moved in, I pushed the head of my bed up against the three bay windows so that in the morning I could see the sky. And I remember that I had no clue. It never occurred to me that anyone could see me. That I remember that I felt like whenever I looked out the window, I never saw anyone, and I never closed my curtains either.
Did you ever find out either of their names?
I never have found out their names, and I looked through the local obituaries obsessively for weeks, and there was never anyone that fit his description. There was never anyone young enough or that looked like him. So no idea. I walked by their place several times, and there are only numbers on the mailboxes and the buzzers, and there are no names. So I can't look up anything. I don't know. Yeah. I have no idea who she is. I have no idea who he was. No idea what he was sick with. I don't know if I've gotten anything right. Maybe they were married, but I didn't get wrong the fact that he died, because I was there. I was there for that, because I saw it all. I think about that a lot, how he chose to die in that bed, in that bedroom. And he didn't choose to go to a hospice or anywhere. He wanted to be in his bedroom. All of those long days from the morning when I looked out, in the evening, he was just exactly the same position. That was where he wanted to be. And it's where all of the happy times were, I guess, and the end times, you know. Just a couple days after it happened, she was up on the roof with a friend doing yoga. And I've watched her lying around a lot. She went out of town, I think, for a bit. And she's still there. I have been watching her recovery. And instead of being this young woman, she looks totally different. She looks so changed. She just looks like this very experienced, world-weary person. She has a job now that gets her up very early because I get up at 6 and she's already dressed and heads out at like 6:15. And the other night I saw her and she was in her bedroom and she was wearing this baggy t-shirt and all the lights were on and she was dancing, just dancing around her room. So yeah, I want her, I want her to move on. This young woman that I was so cranky and bitter about, you know, now I feel so protective and kind of maternal, you know.
If you ran into her like at the corner market or something, do you think you could ever say anything to her?
Yeah, if I ran into her, I wouldn't say a thing. What would I say? I've been watching you through your window. How creepy would that be? Yeah, no way. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't know that. She doesn't know that there's this person that, I don't know, that's this complete stranger that's out there really rooting for her, you know?
Diane Weipert told her story to radio reporter Brianna Breen, who produced this with the folks at Love and Radio, Nick Vanderkolk, and Brendan Baker.
Special thanks to Karen Duffin, to Brendan, Brianna, and to Nick. And there are some wonderful stories on their podcast. You should listen to all of them. It's called Love and Radio. You'll find it at loveandradio.org. I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Chad Abumrad.
We'll be back in a moment.
This is Jean Pelletier in Boston, Massachusetts. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled babbel.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Robert Krulwich. This is Radiolab. On today's show, we're theming it to see or not to see. These are stories about being witness to something, whether you want to be or you don't want to be. And next up,
a story about a set of pictures.
Pictures.
I should say that there are some moments in this story that get a little, what's the word?
Heavy.
Heavy, yeah. So be forewarned. But we'll start with the picture taker.
My name is Lindsay Addario, and I'm a photojournalist.
She's been covering war for the last 15 years.
I've done military embeds, infantry units, patrolling, going in house-to-house searches.
She's worked in, well, everywhere. Sudan, Libya, Lebanon, Pakistan, a million places. She's been kidnapped twice. She's won a Pulitzer, a MacArthur, and she's been called one of the most influential photographers of the past 25 years. In any case, this particular story, can you set it up a little bit?
Sure. So in December of 2009,
she was taking pictures for Time magazine. She was in Afghanistan, Ghazni district, Helmand province, stationed at a base in the middle of the desert.
I was embedded with the medevac team, and their role is to go in and pick up injured troops out of the theater of war.
This is a small team of basically helicopter pilots, medics, doctors.
Basically, whenever there's an injured soldier, these teams are called, whichever team is closest to the injured.
We're talking like helicopter dropping into...
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is fast.
So Lindsay had been embedded with this team for a couple of days, and not much was happening.
So you're just sitting around reading magazines and then rereading the same magazines.
And one night, really late.
I think I was lying in bed and I was totally like, if I wasn't asleep, I was on the verge of sleep. When someone ran was like, there was an alpha.
Alpha is like...
Alpha means the most gravely wounded. Like, you have seconds to get there. I mean, it's life or death.
So she grabs two cameras, her helmet, body armor, runs out to the Blackhawk.
I strap myself in, and we take off. And I think it was about a two-minute flight, which is so fast. And I remember I was shooting the fields as we flew in because I was trying to focus and see what I can see. Luckily, they had lent me a set of night vision goggles, which was really nice of the military because you can't see anything without them in the middle of the night because they are using night vision, so they don't ever turn on the light.
So if you were to look through the camera directly, you would see
nothing.
Just blackness.
Nothing. So what you do for a photographer is you put the night vision goggles in front of the camera lens. So it looks green. It's fluorescent green.
Does that mean that the picture you get is green?
Yes.
Huh. So they fly for 2 minutes through the pitch black, land the helicopter. She has no idea where.
And everything is happening extremely fast. I'm trying to focus as I'm looking out the helicopter door, and suddenly in my viewfinder, I see a man sort of wrapped. I think he was wrapped in a blanket, and he gets put right in front of me on the floor of the Black Hawk. The first thing I thought is, I think he's already dead. He seemed completely unresponsive, and he seemed so young. I just remember looking at his face and thinking, God, what are we doing here?
Within seconds, they're airborne again, flying back to the field hospital. Lindsay takes pictures on that brief flight back, grainy, fluorescent, green images of the medics tending to the soldier, checking his vitals.
We land at the field hospital.
They rushed him on a stretcher into the hospital tent.
And the whole team of medics, Navy nurses, the anesthesiologists, everyone is there. They carry him inside and put him immediately on the table, cut his clothes off. They're cutting his pants off, open up his shirt. And the room starts filling up with everyone because everyone has heard that there's an alpha. And so troops come in from across the base, sort of in support.
She says within minutes, the room went from just a handful of people, 5, 6, to a dozen, 20.
And you can hear a pin drop. I mean, the room is silent except for the doctors. You know, they're trying to resuscitate him. He had lost, I think, 8 or 9 pints of blood. They're bringing in blood. They're bringing in all sorts of things. And
Are you shooting this whole time?
Well, yeah, of course. You know, I'm basically trying to be invisible because it's so sensitive to be a photographer in that situation. What I do, I don't shoot like bang, 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 bang. You know, I shoot one frame and then I put my camera down and I shoot another frame because you can hear the click of the shutter and it is like exponentially louder than normal in a situation like that.
What did you get? Did anyone give you a look of like,
so,
back off or
well,
anything like that?
Well, at one point, I was shooting for probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes maybe, and an officer walked over to me and he said, hey, stop photographing. And,
really?
Yeah. And I put the camera down and I looked at him and I said, I have permission.
She had worked all that out beforehand. As part of the conditions of her embed.
We had had all these conversations. You know, what happens in the case of this? What is my access? What can I do?
But at this point, she says, the room was full of people from across the base who didn't know any of that, didn't know who she was, that she had permission. And so she was sort of at this fork in the road. There were those, like that officer, who clearly felt...
Put the camera down.
Stop.
Obviously, this is not the time to argue or to be disrespectful, so I didn't say anything else. I put the camera down.
But she says the moment she did that...
Several other troops said no. let her shoot. This has to be documented.
Oh, that's interesting. So you have one guy who says, you can't take a picture of this.
Right.
Almost like anything but this.
Right.
And another guy is like, no, this especially.
Right. Right. First of all, the guy who said no was being productive. It made perfect sense for me. But I think the guys who stood up and said this has to be documented, I think at some point everyone realized, like, look, this war is not going away. We are losing so many lives and limbs, and no one is seeing it.
And keep in mind, this is 2009. This is just the tail end of an 18-year ban where the news media couldn't even photograph military coffins. In any case, the officer let it go. Lindsay continued to take pictures for about another 20 minutes. She took pictures of the doctors cutting open the boy's chest, massaging his heart.
At some point, I remember one of the doctors looked up and said, does anyone else have any suggestions, basically, for how to save him? And everyone said no, and they sort of disconnected he died. People were looking down, and then they were looking at each other, and someone went to go get a flag, an American flag, to drape over his body. And I continued photographing, and there was a moment where the whole room was silent and people stood around his body draped with a flag and said a prayer. That, to me, is one of the most powerful images that came out of this whole series.
There's this old idea in photography called the decisive moment, that the world is filled with these far-off realities, but every so often a photograph can capture a moment that, boom, takes you there. This is one of those photos. In the picture, you see all these men and women standing in kind of a loose semicircle. Some of them still have their blue surgical gloves on. They look totally spent. They're all looking in different directions, and they all look like they're not even there, like they're totally lost in their own thoughts.
Their attention is clearly inwards.
Yeah.
I'm sure all those troops were like, God, that could have been me. Why couldn't we save him? What are we doing here in Afghanistan? Is this war worth it? And to read the expressions on their faces, like, it's even, you can be at war as a journalist, but never actually get to the heart of the war because we don't have access or people don't open up. And I felt like I really had reached the crux of the war.
Interesting.
It was war.
You'd seen an essence of something.
Yeah.
But then came a problem. Any photos that she had taken that included that soldier's face or any other identifying marks like tattoos, and he did have tattoos, according to the rules of her embed, she couldn't use those photos without the soldier's permission.
Right.
And you never got to speak to him.
No.
So was it days later, weeks later, months later, where you began to ask yourself, who do I talk to?
It was minutes later. It's the military does not let a journalist cover something like this without coming directly to that person. And so literally, like, I followed the young man's body out to the morgue, and they had to walk him outside. And I remember the moon was so bright that night, and I was shooting with the moonlight as he was being carried outside. And then I went back to the tent where I was staying, and within minutes, the military PAO, the Marines public affairs officers, came and said, you can't send those images out without permission from the next of kin.
That's the rule. If a soldier is unconscious and then dies before giving permission,
I have to then go to the next of kin. And I said, of course, I understand. You know, I'm not doing anything with those photos in that moment. I sign this piece of paper. When I give my word, I keep that word, you know.
Sure.
But then the other side of me was like, you know, in Vietnam, no one was signing pieces of paper. And in Vietnam, no one had to go to the next of kin before they published anything. And that's why the American public, I think, rose up against the war in Vietnam, because they saw the most graphic, devastating images that were uncensored.
So then what do you do in that circumstance? I mean, I imagine you go to the next of kin, right?
Well, you're not allowed as a journalist to reach out to the next of kin. They asked me, are you interested in being contacted by the next of kin if they're willing to speak to you?
Oh, so you can't even actually call?
No, they will not give you the information.
Oh.
But I said, of course I would like to be contacted by the next of kin, and please pass my information on. And I was sort of just waiting.
I mean, at this point, were you thinking the pictures would ever see the light of day?
I had no idea. And
a few days later.
maybe less than a week.
Her embed was over. She was flying to JFK on her way to meet her family for Christmas.
And I had voicemails on my telephone. And I listened, and it was his father. And he left me a voicemail, and he said, "I understand you were with my son when he died, and I would like to talk to you, and this is my phone number."
Wow.
I sort of choked up just listening to his voice, anticipating how difficult that phone call would be.
That phone call, when all the fallout, is coming up.
It's Lauren Drake from Dallas, Texas. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Okay, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
This is Radio Lab. So Lindsay Addario, the photographer, has these photos, these intense photos of a soldier dying, but she can't use them without getting permission from the next of kin.
Right.
A few days later?
I had voicemails on my telephone, and I listened, and it was his father.
His father's name is Todd Taylor. Son's name was Jonathan Taylor. And just to jump ahead for a second, as we were talking about the phone call and the fallout from that phone call, I had all of these questions about what Todd Taylor was thinking, and questions about his son, things that Lindsay couldn't possibly answer. So at a certain point in the interview, she just told me,
"I don't know. I mean, you could maybe interview him.
Do you think he would? I mean, is there any prohibition on me talking to him?"
Well, I'd be happy to give you his information.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to him.
I mean, you can try.
Lindsay put us in touch, and I'll just tell you about the visit for a second. Todd Taylor was willing to talk. He had two conditions. One was like, if I'm going to do a story about these photos of his son, I should at least get to know his son a little bit. And the second was that I come down to Florida to meet him and his family personally.
The destination is on your left.
So I did.
Hey. Good morning. How are you?
Good to meet you. The Taylor family live in a section of Jacksonville that's near a naval base, so there are a lot of military families there.
Yeah, you come on in and meet all the doggies.
Todd is actually ex-Navy himself. He introduced me to his three giant boxers.
No jumping.
Or they sort of introduced themselves. And then...
This is my daughter, my youngest. That's
good to meet you.
Yep, Jed.
I met his daughters.
I am Lauren Taylor. I am 16 going on 17.
Oh, God. You had to add that in.
My name's Mackenzie Taylor. I am Jonathan's other sister, and I'm 20 years old.
That little voice you heard in the background is Easton. He's about two.
That's one of the babies she watches. Hey, handsome.
Mackenzie works as a nanny.
My name's Paige Larson. I'm Jonathan's stepsister, and I'm 21.
My name's Sue Taylor, and I'm Jonathan's stepmom.
And then, of course,
I'm Todd Taylor. I'm Jonathan's dad. We're here in my house in Jacksonville, Florida, and today is Jonathan's birthday. It's April 8th.
2015. So he would have been how old today?
28 years old today. 28.
When I got there, they pulled out photo albums of Jonathan, and we all sat at the kitchen table and looked at pictures.
Right there.
Pictures of him as a baby.
Of course, that was very young.
Toddler.
This was on the Disney cruise. I took him on.
Adolescent.
Kennedy Space Center.
Teenager. You see him running track.
He liked cross country.
Going to prom.
That was Jonathan's girlfriend.
The thing you notice immediately in all the pictures.
Yeah, big blue eyes.
Mm-hmm. He's got these eyes that are not just blue, they're really blue. Like if you boosted the brightness in Photoshop or something.
Yeah, I think we're on vacation here, but...
The other thing you notice...
Mm-hmm. His facial expressions are really funny in some of these.
He was a big class clown.
A lot of goofy faces.
Very goofy. Oh,
big goofball. Yeah. Goofball. Yeah. Definitely knew how to make anybody laugh.
Full of energy. Always into stuff.
He kept the boys away, too.
Definitely. Most definitely. He made sure if I had boyfriends, he'd call them just to see what grades they had.
Really? He would check on their grades?
Yeah. Kind of give them a little interview.
I do remember he was very protective. If I had a crush, he'd be like, oh, no, you're not going to have a crush. No, no boys.
There was one time before he left for Afghanistan, I got really sick with a fever. And I remember him holding my hand just so he could make sure that I was okay and took care of me.
They told me story after story about how he doted on his sisters, how he loved to read and wanted to become a history teacher after his 4 years in the Marines. And inevitably, the conversation turned to the day that they found out he died, December 1st, 2009. They get a call from Jonathan's mom saying, it's that classic scene, oh my God, there are two Marines at the door.
And we just kind of like left everything.
Sue, Todd, the girls jump in the car, race over.
They all wanted to get out. We're like, no, because we didn't really know what was going to happen. So we made all the girls stay in the car.
And I remember walking in the door and everyone just had this look on their face like the world had just ended. And I remember asking what had happened, and my mom had told me that he was gone. And the first thing I did was run to his room because everything was the same before he had left. I remember opening his closet and grabbing one of his shirts and just holding on to it because it still had his scent on it. That night was really hard.
One thing that had never occurred to me, totally caught me off guard in thinking about those pictures, is that when those Marines came to the door and told them the news, well, they didn't actually give much news.
This right here was one of, this is what was read.
Todd actually read me the circumstances of death statement.
Hostile action, result of multiple traumatic injuries received as a member of a dismounted patrol that was struck by an ID while conducting combat operations in the Helmand province. That was it, on patrol, night patrol. That was all I had.
So you didn't know anything?
That's it.
Jonathan's unit was still in Afghanistan, so he couldn't talk to anyone. He had no clue what happened to his son. So when that casualty assistance officer told him, actually, there was a photographer in the room with your son when he died.
Automatically, I was like, I wanted to call her.
Earlier in my conversation with Lindsay, I'd asked her, what do you remember of the call?
So the call, I went to my mother's house in Connecticut, and I asked my mother to be left alone, which in a big Italian-American family means does not happen
it's
very
not
often.
It's not a small request.
No, she sort of looked at me like, what? And I went up into the guest bedroom, and I called him. And he picked up. I think he thanked me for calling him. I don't remember exactly what we said, but I said, you know, I was with your son when he died, and I will give you as much or as little information as you want. And he said, I want to know everything.
Because I wasn't there. I was here.
He said, I want to know every single thing. I want to be with my son.
Just to lose him and not be there for him, that was hard. Really hard.
And I felt sort of very awkward because I felt like, you know, why was I privy to this moment? And he as the father could not be privy.
The most important question to me was, did he suffer? Do you think, did he suffer?
I said, no.
She told me, Ms. Taylor, I don't think he suffered. I think he was in shock.
I told him everything. How much blood his son lost. How long did they try to save him? And at some point, I said, look, I have these pictures. I have all of these pictures. I shot everything. And I need your permission to publish the ones that show his face.
Oh, yeah. She asked me for permission. And
he was quiet.
I said, I told her yes. But
he said, can I see them?
And I wanted to see them first.
Before I give permission, I want to see every photo. And I said, you know, I'm not sure you want to see these photos. Because they're graphic, but he wanted to see the outtake. He wanted to see every photo.
All of them.
Yeah.
Of course, we were on the phone. I couldn't show him pictures. And legally, I needed permission from Time Magazine to show him anything because, you know, as a journalist, you can't show anything to anyone until it's published. You don't show people pictures of journalism before you publish them.
This is one of those cardinal rules that's drilled into every journalist's head. If you show a subject the raw stuff before it's out there, you're kind of giving up the only independence you've got. That's why she says, ordinarily,
I would never, ever, ever show.
Just to play it out for a second, to be cynical about it, if you show him the pictures, he might take away permission that he might have otherwise give you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You can say as a publication, no, I won't show you those pictures before you have to just say yes or no. Do you give your permission?
Like, in a way, if you get down to it, I feel like one of the fundamental layers here is just like a question of whose rights when it comes to that information is more important.
I could hear an argument that says the battle is important. It was authorized by public figures. It is carrying America's message into the world. And shouldn't Americans see what goes on?
Yeah, but I could hear an argument that says shouldn't a dad be able to protect who sees his son in that situation?
Yeah.
In any case, Lindsay called her editors at Time. They had a series of conversations that went all the way up to the editor of Time.
We had a very intense conversation, and we collectively made a decision to show him the photos.
To say that decision was unusual from their perspective would be severely understating it.
When I first got these from FedEx, I knew they were coming, and I was actually scared to look at him. And I saw my son there. And I just kept looking and looking. You can see these were in the medevac when they got him on. You can see the night vision lens. There's Jonathan's body, chest, there's his face, there's the oxygen. Still has his watch on still. See his eyes closed there, that was.
Yeah.
So many hands and they're working. You can see they're doing CPR there. Now, here you see, right leg is really mangled and broken. That's really why he lost so much blood. It was just all right in here.
Some of these pictures are...
Well, there's some of them that are...
Really hard to see.
Yeah. But even though they show the ugliness of war, I've got a piece of Jonathan. This is my treasure. Mm. I'll show you one of the pictures that, to me, it always stands out.
He brought up the picture of the prayer. All those people standing in a semicircle with faraway eyes.
Right here. You just see a little different in their faces here. I mean, it meant something. He was somebody.
Yeah.
He wasn't just a number.
Todd said he wanted people to see this picture and the others.
To convey what's happening over there. This is going on every day.
And he says for him, it's not a political thing. You can feel however you want to feel about the wars we're in. For him, it's about people seeing what is actually happening.
I mean, I wanted to let people see the sacrifices that these boys do.
It took Todd and his family over a month to decide what to do about those pictures. Whether to grant Time permission to run the photos or not. He says ultimately he called Jonathan's mother over.
Her and her husband. And my wife and I, we all discussed it.
And ultimately, he said no. And it was a lot of back and forth.
He said no to showing any pictures at all.
Well, he can't say no to any pictures because...
Because there's pictures without the face.
Yeah. Exactly. He said no to any pictures with the face or identifying marks.
We decided really that we didn't want these pictures to get out for fear that his sisters somehow they would get back to them. And that was the big thing. I didn't want them to be able to see this yet. As their dad, I want to protect them from seeing certain things. And so we decided not to do it.
Time had planned to run a whole photo spread on the medevac team trying to save Jonathan Taylor's life. But since they now couldn't use most of those photos, they had to make the photo spread more general.
What had been basically the death of a soldier ultimately became a photo essay on the medevac team, and those pictures were maybe two pictures or three pictures in that spread, but they were not the focus.
The prayer photo is in the new spread because in that photo... you can't see his body because it's covered with a flag. There are no identifying marks. But somehow in that context, it's it's not got the same impact, weirdly.
Because you're seeing the after without the before?
Exactly. And you know,
let's see here.
Todd showed me the original photo spread because they had sent that to him.
You know?
Again, super unusual.
So this is the feature they wanted to do.
Yeah. You can see the pictures are so much more clear. This is kind of the layout it's going to be. It's called 29 minutes, graphing it out.
Minute by minute.
This whole process.
So there you see all the before pictures that lead up to the prayer. And what it seemed to me is like if you don't see all that stuff, the wounds and the blood and the tenderness as they tried to comfort him and then the emptiness they feel when they couldn't save him, like if you don't see all that, you're not really standing with them in that prayer at the end. You're still seeing them across the space.
Yeah, that's interesting.
In the original spread, you are there in that room.
And they did a great job, you know.
It's really powerful. And I couldn't help but think that, like, maybe this would have created that conversation that Lindsay talked about just a tiny bit. And, like, how weird that I'm one of the only people to see it. And to know that, like, the only reason I can describe it to you is because I'm on the radio.
You know, I will always feel like journalistically we sacrificed, you know, we did not tell the story as powerfully as we could have, but we had integrity and I feel like we treated everyone with respect and we kept our word.
Lindsay and Todd now stay in touch over email once or twice a year. And in terms of keeping your word, Todd has made a deal with his daughters that they can see the pictures when they turn 21. But interestingly, the three of them don't agree as to whether they want to. Paige and Mackenzie, who are about to turn 21, say they don't want to see the pictures.
I just couldn't handle it.
Yeah. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, I think for me, I just don't want to see him in pain, you know?
That's Mackenzie.
Yeah, my thing is I just don't want to see it because I'd rather just remember him in one piece, how he was. I'm just too sensitive.
That's Paige. Now, Lauren, the youngest.
For me.
She says she needs to see those pictures.
Because I want to know what he went through, and I like constantly knowing things, and I don't like things being kept from me. And I just want to, I guess I just want a visual of.
It sounds like she says she knows he's gone, but she still somehow needs proof.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it happened, she knows it happened. But so it feels real. Okay, so big thanks to Pat Walters, Kira Pollack, the Taylor family, and of course, Lindsay Addario. She has a book out now called It's What I Do, which is sort of a memoir about her war photography and how it's changed her life. And that book is filled with her photography.
Anything like the ones we didn't see?
Well, there's some amazing pictures in there, but nothing like these ones.
So now for our last story. We're not going to be looking through a window or through a camera on this one. This one takes place face-to-face. There are two people, one right with the other, at a moment that is too powerful, too mysterious, too amazing to not share with you. It's called Gone. This is a reading from Heaven's Coast by Mark Doty, who's one of, in my opinion anyway, one of the great living poets in America. This, however, is not poetry. This is prose. It's Mark's description of the death of his longtime partner, Wally. Thursday night, January 20th, Wally's smiling. I get the Polaroid and ask him to show me that smile once again, and he does, the last time he'll be able to. Friday, January 21st, the last words I will write for a month. Time's the engine that decks the world in its beautiful clothes, and not one is exempt. Wally's breathing changes, becomes heavier, regular. Breathing's work now, as if it were an audible sign of some transformative process within. He seems turned in on himself, not speaking. I don't think he can speak now. I touch him and talk to him. We know it's time for the morphine in an eyedropper on his tongue. Perhaps there's no pain, but if there is, he couldn't tell us, and the opiate will ease the work for him. Rena comes and says goodbye. His eyes are closed, and when she comes into the room, but he opens the right one, the still,
good side of his face and he takes her in. She tells him she hopes he's not scared, and they spend a long time looking at each other. She says, "Knowing you has been a great gift in my life," and that she'll always carry him in her heart. And then she's quiet, giving him her love. And then we looked at each other for some time, she told me later, and I kissed him, and I wished him a safe and joyful journey, and I left, and I didn't see him in his body again. I call his mother, who's planning to come on Sunday. She comes Saturday morning instead, but by then his eyes are closed. She sits alone with him for a while. He opens his right eye just a tiny bit. We can tell that he sees her. All that afternoon he looks out at us through that little space, but I know he sees and he registers, and I know that he's loving us actively, and I know, if nothing else about this man, after 13 years, I know that. So into the line of his vision I bring Thisbe and Portia, the cats, and Arden and Beau, the dogs, and then I sit there myself all afternoon, the lamps on, since the house is circled in snow and early winter darkness. The afternoon is so quiet and deep it seems almost to ring like chimes, a cold struck bell. I sit into the evening when he closes his eyes. There is an inaudible roaring, a rush beneath the surface of things, beneath the surface of Wally, who is now almost no surface, as if I could see into him, into the great hurrying current, that energy, that forward motion, which is life going on. I was never this close to anyone in my life. His living so deep and absolute that it pulls me close to that interior current so far inside his life and my own. I know I am going to be more afraid than I have ever been, but right now I am not afraid. I am face to face with the deepest movement in the world, the point of my love's deepest reality, where he is most himself, even if that self empties out into no one, swift river hurrying into the tumble of rivers out of individuality, into the great rushing whirlwind of currents, God moving on the face of the waters. Suddenly I'm so tired, I think I can't stay awake another minute. Darren comes in, he's been in and out all day, spelling me, seeing where things are, and says he'll sit with Wally a while. I say, I'll sleep on the couch for an hour. I don't think I've been lying down 10 minutes when I sit up wide awake. Darren is in fact on the way to fetch me, but I've come on my own. I know it's time. I say to Wally, while the breath comes more shallowly, all the love in the world goes with you. Each breath he draws in goes a little less further into his body, so easily. He never struggles. There's no sense of difficulty, no sense of holding on. Arden, the dog, stands up suddenly, moved by what imperative I don't know, and falls out of the bed. Darren says, that's just Arden, he's okay, not wanting anything to steal Wally's attention from where he is now. I say, you go easy, babe. Go free. The world seemed in absolute suspension, nothing moving anywhere, everything centered. Go easy. But you go. Mark Doty has a new book of poetry just out called Deep Lane.
I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich. Thanks for listening.